Thanks for downloading this edition of The Why Factor, a programme that seeks to find out why we do the things we do. I hope you enjoy it.
They're chopping off our heads in the Middle East. They want to kill us. They want to kill us. They want to kill our country. They want to knock out our cities. And don't tell me it doesn't work. Torture works, okay, folks? Torture, you know, I have these guys. Torture doesn't work. Believe me, it works, okay?
And that from the Republican presidential candidate last year, now President Donald J. Trump.
I have spoken as recently as 24 hours ago with people at the highest level of intelligence, and I asked them the question, does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes, absolutely.
When the first strike landed on the soles of my feet, it was beyond understanding.
It was a searing pain in your legs and your abdomen, but it wasn't so much the pain as the inability to recognize where that pain was going to take you and how much more you could endure.
I wanted to scream and I couldn't. It was as if my whole nervous system had exploded.
BBC World Service, I'm Becky Milligan. Welcome to The Why Factor. This week, torture. Why do we still use it, and can it ever be justified? The 1994 UN Convention Against Torture says no exceptional circumstances whatsoever may be invoked as a justification of torture. And yet, it's still used in more than 130 countries. In 2014, a Senate committee published a report on the use of torture under the presidency of George W. Bush and concluded torture was not an effective means of acquiring intelligence or gaining cooperation from detainees.
My name is Marina Nemat. I was born in 1965 in Tehran, Iran. And I was just your very average, fun-loving, too much fun-loving teenager.
Marina Nemat, who's a Catholic, had dreams of going to medical school and marrying Donny Osmond. But in 1979, the Shah was overthrown in the Islamic Revolution.
We had grown up in bikinis on the beach. And now they were telling us that wearing nail polish is illegal, wearing bikinis is illegal, that we had to cover up. And we were mad. So we were on the streets protesting, and the wave of arrest began in 1981.
I supported the invasion of Iraq initially in 2003. I, like many Americans, have been affected by 9/11. I had the kind of skills that were in desperate need in a place like Iraq.
So when the opportunity came up to be an interrogator, Eric Fair jumped at it. He'd previously been a military police officer and served in the army before joining a private security firm. He arrived in Iraq in 2004 and worked in Abu Ghraib prison and detention centres in Fallujah.
There was a desperate attempt to get a handle on what was going on. And so we were tasked with interviewing and debriefing and interrogating thousands of Iraqi prisoners. The idea was that they had information that would lead to sort of a more effective way of fighting this war.
He says what he did to the prisoners was torture. But what precisely does he mean by that?
The idea that torture can only be waterboarding or can only be slapping or can only be punching or kicking, or it's not about the physical interaction. It's about removing an individual's humanity and not treating them as a human.
President George Bush denied that what people like Eric were doing was torture, preferring the term enhanced interrogation, although the former CIA chief, Leon Panetta, called it a euphemism.
The priority intelligence requirement at the time was for the location of chemical weapons, and so I did hold interrogations trying to ascertain who had been part of the chemical weapons program and where these weapons were hidden. So the frustration level was high, and we looked for opportunities to push the limits. The kind of procedures that we were implementing in places like Abu Ghraib were torture. things like sleep deprivation and stress positions absolutely meet the guidelines of torture.
Back in Iran in the early 80s, Marina Neymat's friends were being arrested one by one. Her turn came in early 1982. She was just 16. The Revolutionary Guard came to her home and took her to the notorious Evin prison in Tehran.
I could hear a man screaming in a way that it made breathing for me difficult. And something happened there. I mean, I lost the ability to think. There was nothing but those screams. I was 90 pounds. I was very thin and very small. I mean, 16. And when they handcuffed me, they realized my hands are going to slide out of the cuffs. And they laughed. They put both of my wrists together. They put the two wrists into one cuff. And as it clicked, my right wrist cracked. And I screamed my head off, and the torture had not even begun.
It was not as if we stepped into Abu Ghraib and said, what are ways that we can torture or interrogate and no one will find out and we can all stay quiet? These were things that we would have essentially staff meetings about. There was paperwork involved. There was paperwork about what you could and could not do. There were limits. And there was paperwork that needed to be filed when you did implement some of these techniques.
Someone came and he said, I'm going to lash the soles of your feet. I mean, I thought, well, you know, how much can that hurt?
The case that often sticks in my mind is a sleep deprivation that I conducted in Fallujah. It was an individual who was working with a gentleman that we were attempting to track down, and another interrogator asked me to keep him awake that night. He was kept in a room by himself, and I would go in, turn on all the lights. There were no windows. It was perfectly dark. Wake him up, have him stand naked for a few minutes, and then put him back to sleep.
When the first strike landed, I mean, the pain that I felt, it was as if my whole nervous system had exploded. I wanted to scream and I couldn't. It just kept coming. And I tried to count the strikes. I don't know, maybe I got to 8, 9, I can't remember. I started praying, I started saying Hail Marys. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you, and I forgot the rest of it. I really, honestly, I wished to die. I would have taken death at any moment without a thought.
The assault that occurs during torture actually damages the parts of the brain that you want access to.
Shane O'Mara is a professor of experimental brain research at Trinity College Dublin. He studied the effects of torture on the brain.
If you starve people, if you deprive them of liquids, if you freeze them, if you overheat them, if you subject them to threat of imminent death, sleep deprives them, all of these things are uniformly destructive of the integrated functions of the brain. And worse than that, we know with certainty that if we impose extreme stressor states on you for prolonged periods of time, the parts of the brain that are concerned with recall of prior events are actually eaten away by the effects of these stressors. So there's a long series of papers that have been conducted by the UK military, the Scandinavian military, the Canadian military, and in particular the US military, where combat soldiers are subject to sleep deprivation for extended periods of time. They have live bullets fired at them. They're undernourished. They're dehydrated. And if you do experiments where you measure memory, you measure mood, you measure response times, reaction times, all of those kinds of things, pre-exposure and post-exposure, what you find is a uniform degradation in every measured aspect of psychological function.
Even if this kind of evidence points to why torture doesn't work, that information and confessions obtained under duress are unreliable and possibly false, there are still many other reasons found to justify torture.
They say it's for the Western security, it's to save their families, it's for communism, it's for their religion, to save millions of lives, to stop the Islamists from taking over, to stop the communists from taking over, to stop the capitalists from taking over. I mean, there's always a reason.
Writer and human rights activist Ariel Dorfman wrote Death and the Maiden, a play about a torture victim who encounters her torturer in later life.
And of course, once you start, you can't stop. People who torture keep on torturing. They keep on torturing until some of them break. And some of them do break and they repent. And they end up as victims themselves of the fact that they have been at the service of a really evil cause.
Professor O'Mara argues that there are more effective methods other than torture to obtain crucial information from prisoners.
Hans-Joachim Scharf was a legendary German interrogator during World War II who did not use coercive methods for his interrogations and was regarded by the Germans and by the Allies as the best interrogator that they had ever encountered. And he would never, ever ask a direct question. His questions were always oblique. And the airmen who were interrogated by him, there were many UK and US and others who were interrogated by him, all had said afterwards, we just believed we were having a conversation. And he got all sorts of things out of me, but I don't know how he did it. And ironically, Scharf went to the US after the Second World War and trained many FBI interrogators.
And Professor O'Mara says that we should learn from Napoleon, who wrote in the early 1800s, it has always been recognised that this way of interrogating men by putting them to torture produces nothing worthwhile.
The brain is a limited bandwidth processor. You're only capable of attending to so many things at once. These kinds of stressors have profound deleterious effects on the brain. They cause the release of large quantities of stress hormone, and they do not in any way facilitate the recall of veridical information. Instead, what you get, and you see this from the Senate torture report, is an inability to recall actual facts, what has happened to you in the past. And worse than that, people who have been tortured simply make stuff up.
As they were beating you, they don't even pause to ask you any questions. They just keep beating. And then you realize this is not at all about information because they give you documents to sign, you sign everything. And after like 10 strikes, you're ready to tell them whatever they want to hear. I mean, you're going to make up fiction, the most amazing fiction ever.
Eric Fair, who confesses to torturing prisoners held in Iraq in 2004, says that sometimes they did extract some vital intelligence.
I implemented stress positions on a younger prisoner, a boy really, and he did give up information that we were able to verify and led to the capture of some really important and dangerous equipment and IED-type operations. So I guess it's nice that we got that equipment off the streets. But there were certainly other people that we interrogated who gave us information that we would pass up the chain that we never knew if it was verified. It wasn't as if we tracked down every single case. So, I mean, of the thousands of Iraqis, if not tens of thousands of Iraqis who spent time in our detention facilities, yes, people were interrogated and likely tortured who had no information.
Torture is not to get information. And torture is not to kill you. I mean, there are much easier ways to kill people. And then you realize that torture, it aims to kill your soul.
Torture is not really used for human information gathering where you're interested in getting at the truth. Torture is used in all sorts of countries for all sorts of reasons, principally to extract confessions to short-circuit legal processes. If you want to spread terror in a population, visiting extremes of duress on individuals, breaking their bodies, and then dumping them in the street is a very, very good way of frightening the population at large and sending out a message that this is what will happen to you if you resist us.
One piece of torture equipment at Eric Fair's disposal in Fallujah was the Palestinian chair. He says he witnessed it being used.
It was a tiny chair, 2 or 3 feet tall, with plastic zip ties at the bottom, and it would force you down into a crouched position. And so we felt like we needed to experience it first before we used it. And, you know, we were both only in it for a minute or two, so we sort of locked each other in. It was a searing pain in your legs and your abdomen, but it wasn't so much the pain as the inability to recognize where that pain was going to take you and how much more you could endure. Now, we had the luxury of getting out of the chair when we were done, but for someone who didn't know how long that was going to last, whether it was 10 minutes or 10 hours or 10 days, it's the unknown. And this is the truth with all forms of torture. It's the unknown. It's taking someone's mind and putting them in a place of an unknown where they can't know what's coming. You can do that without ever laying a hand on a person. And so this issue that torture is somehow physical, I think, is misleading. Torture is a mental issue, and it's destroying someone's sense of hope and destroying their will.
It's clear when you look at the testimony of people who signed up to engage in interrogation in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo, they thought they were doing the right thing. But, of course, they discovered when you're in a small room with somebody who's screaming at you to stop, that actually this is degrading for everyone concerned.
We had a sense then that we weren't doing anything illegal. But I think most of us, and I say this with some confidence, had a really good sense that we were doing something morally questionable. But the idea that you would just see something that you were uncomfortable with and quit was not the way the Army worked. And it's not the way the Army should work. It was so hard to pull away from that belief in the institution. And not just the institution, but the belief in the friends that I was with and the people that I was working with. And these were not terrible, ugly people. These were very good, professional people. When I say that I'm a torturer for using enhanced interrogation, I'm well aware that I'm accusing my colleagues of the same thing. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Torture damages the individual that you are torturing. It damages you as the torturer because reports of trauma, drug abuse, and suicide among ex-torturers are legion, and it corrupts and corrodes the institutions of the state.
Former interrogator Eric Fair admits torturing prisoners in Iraq, but how does he justify his actions?
You recognize that you're controlling another human being, and so I don't have a good answer for this other than to say it has sort of, in some sense, destroyed who I used to be, and in large part because I recognize that I destroyed who these people were.
I think it's more horrific than the death of the body, because when the death of the body occurs, suffering is over. But when the death of the soul occurs, it leaves this aftershock. I mean, it's just empty. It's a void. And you're stuck in it. You're not dead. You're not alive. You're somewhere in between. It did something to my soul. I'm incapable of feeling the full extent of human emotion. This is what happens when you're tortured.
Thanks for listening to The Y Factor. There are many more episodes to listen to, such as conspiracy theories, nostalgia, and the female orgasm. You'll find them at bbcworldservice.com/Y Factor.